Have you ever walked into a room and completely forgotten why you went there, or struggled to recall the name of someone you just met? You're not alone. Memory lapses are universal human experiences, yet they often trigger anxiety about cognitive decline. Lisa Genova, a Harvard-trained neuroscientist and best-selling author of Still Alice, brings reassuring clarity to this common concern in her illuminating work, Remember. The book has garnered praise from neurologists and memory researchers worldwide, with Genova's TED Talk on Alzheimer's prevention amassing over 5 million views. Her unique ability to translate complex neuroscience into accessible wisdom makes this book as comforting as it is informative. Drawing on both cutting-edge research and relatable examples, Genova shows us that most memory failures aren't signs of disease, but simply reflections of how our brains naturally work. As Oprah Winfrey noted after featuring Genova's work, she helps us understand the science behind what we've experienced all along, that memory is imperfect, malleable, and deeply human. Memory isn't a single system, but a complex network of interconnected processes. Each memory physically changes your brain, creating lasting alterations in response to experiences. Our sensory experiences, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and emotions, become linked neural patterns that persist through structural changes between neurons, forming connected circuits that can later be reactivated as memories. Memory formation happens in four basic steps: encoding, translating perceptions into neurological language; consolidation, linking unrelated neural activity into a pattern; storage, maintaining these patterns through structural changes; and retrieval, activating these connections to recall experiences. The hippocampus, a seahorse-shaped structure deep in your brain, is essential for memory consolidation. It weaves together disparate information into retrievable units. Without a functioning hippocampus, as seen in early Alzheimer's or in famous case study Henry Molaison, HM, who had his removed surgically, new memories cannot form. Unlike other brain functions with specific locations, memories aren't stored in one place, but distributed throughout the brain in the same neural patterns that processed the original experience. What's fascinating is that remembering isn't replaying a recording. It's reconstructing an experience by activating connected neural networks. This reconstructive nature explains why memory is imperfect, yet remarkably adaptable. Our brains aren't designed to remember everything. They prioritize what matters most while discarding the mundane. This selective process isn't a flaw, but a feature that prevents information overload. The capacity for memory appears virtually limitless. Consider Akira Haraguchi, who at age 69 memorized pi to 111,700 digits, a feat possible for anyone with a healthy brain. The average adult has memorized 20,000 to 100,000 words. Chess masters know roughly 100,000 possible moves, and concert pianists commit tens of thousands of notes to memory. These extraordinary capabilities demonstrate our brain's remarkable potential when properly engaged. Memory begins with attention. You simply cannot remember what you never noticed. Without focused attention, activated neurons won't link and memories won't form. Your memory isn't a video camera recording everything. It's highly selective, capturing only what you consciously notice and deem significant. This selective process evolved to help us survive by remembering important information while filtering out the irrelevant. Think about your daily commute. Have you ever arrived at your destination with no memory of the journey? This isn't a memory failure. The memory was never created because your attention was elsewhere, likely absorbed in thoughts, music, or phone conversations. Similarly, most people can't accurately draw the Apple logo or identify a real penny among fakes despite thousands of exposures. These examples demonstrate what psychologists call inattentional blindness. We often fail to notice things right in front of us when our attention is directed elsewhere. When meeting someone new, like Bob, you might forget his name immediately because you didn't consciously attend to it, instead focusing on other aspects like appearance or the conversation itself. Our distraction-filled world with smartphones and multitasking severely compromises our attention and therefore our memories. Studies show that people who check their phones during conversations remember significantly less content than those who remain fully engaged, sometimes retaining less than 50% of the information discussed. Each time we divide our attention, we sacrifice memory formation. Research indicates that it takes our brain up to 23 minutes to fully refocus after an interruption, creating gaps in our memory during these transition periods. This explains why meditation and mindfulness practices improve memory. They strengthen our ability to sustain attention in the present moment. Regular meditation practitioners show increased gray matter density in brain regions associated with learning, memory, and emotional regulation. By training ourselves to focus completely on one thing at a time, we create stronger, more vivid memories. Studies of long-term meditators reveal they perform significantly better on both attention and memory tasks compared to non-meditators. Maximum attention enables maximum memory formation and retention. The implications are profound. Memory improvement begins not with fancy techniques, but with the simple act of paying full attention. This means creating environments conducive to focus, turning off notifications, designating specific times for deep work, and practicing single-tasking instead of multitasking. Next time you want to remember something, eliminate distractions, stop multitasking, and give it your complete focus. Your future self will thank you when that memory remains accessible precisely when you need it. Understanding this attention-memory connection can transform how we approach learning, work, and relationships in our increasingly distracted world. Working memory holds information just long enough to use it, about 15 to 30 seconds before it's displaced by new information. You can feel this when racing to enter a Wi-Fi password before it vanishes from your mind. Psychologists call visual working memory your visuospatial scratchpad, like words hastily written in disappearing ink, and auditory working memory your phonological loop, a brief echo in your head. You can extend this brief window by repeating information, essentially refreshing the timer. Working memory has limited capacity, only 7 plus or minus 2 items, though this can be increased through chunking information into meaningful groups, like remembering phone numbers as 617-555-4062 instead of 10 separate digits. Longer, multisyllabic words are harder to hold in working memory than short ones. Working memory serves as the gateway to long-term memory. Details that capture attention and have special meaning can be sent to the hippocampus for consolidation into memories that might last decades. This bottleneck explains why we struggle to remember multiple pieces of new information presented simultaneously. When someone rattles off several instructions in quick succession, the later items often displace earlier ones before they can be properly encoded. This limitation isn't a design flaw, but an evolutionary adaptation. Our ancestors needed to focus on immediate threats and opportunities rather than processing everything in their environment. By filtering information through the narrow channel of working memory, our brains prioritize what matters most in the moment. Understanding working memory's constraints can help us work with our brains rather than against them. When learning something new, break information into manageable chunks, process one piece fully before moving to the next, and create meaningful connections between new information and existing knowledge. These strategies help overcome the working memory bottleneck and increase the likelihood of successful long-term memory formation. Declarative memories, facts, and experiences require conscious effort to retrieve, often feeling labored and frustrating. Unlike these, muscle memory, our memory for motor skills and procedures, operates unconsciously and effortlessly. Once learned through repetition, skills like riding a bike, typing, or complex athletic movements become automatic, requiring no conscious thought. While semantic and episodic memories consolidate via the hippocampus, muscle memories form through the basal ganglia and cerebellum, which link individual physical steps into connected neural patterns. Even Henry Mollison, who lost his ability to form new conscious memories after hippocampus removal, could still develop new muscle memories, like mirror drawing a star, though he never remembered learning the skill. With practice, the neural connections for a skill strengthen, and the brain regions controlling that movement actually enlarge, explaining why experts have more brain matter devoted to their specialty. Mastery requires extensive repetition, possibly thousands of hours, though individual aptitude varies. Once established, these memories allow us to perform complex actions automatically, while our conscious mind focuses on higher-level thinking. This explains why you might forget the combination to a lock, but your fingers remember the pattern, or why professional musicians can perform flawlessly despite being nervous or distracted. The body remembers what the conscious mind might forget. The resilience of muscle memory offers hope to those experiencing cognitive decline. Even in advanced Alzheimer's disease, procedural memories often remain intact long after other memory systems fail. Patients may forget family members' names, but still play piano pieces learned decades earlier, or knit complex patterns without conscious recollection of how they learned these skills. Understanding the distinction between declarative and procedural memory systems helps us appreciate the brain's remarkable complexity and adaptability. It also suggests practical approaches to learning. Skills practiced until they become automatic remain accessible even under stress or when other memory systems falter. Semantic memory, the Wikipedia of your brain, stores facts and information you know about yourself and the world, disconnected from when or where you learned them. Unlike episodic memories that are personal recollections of past experiences, remember when we went to Budapest? Semantic memories are simply information you know. Budapest is the capital of Hungary. These include everything from scientific facts like the speed of light to personal data like your birthday and address. Creating lasting semantic memories typically requires study, practice, and repetition with the intentional goal of retention. Sometimes life naturally provides the repetition needed, as when babies learn first words from parents' constant repetition, or when baristas memorize regular customers' complex drink orders through daily interactions. For information that must be learned quickly, like studying for an exam, distributed practice beats cramming. The spacing effect gives your hippocampus more time to consolidate what you're learning. Self-testing dramatically strengthens memory. Studies show it can more than double recall compared to passive rereading. Making information meaningful is also crucial. Chess masters can remember complex board positions only when they represent meaningful game scenarios, and mnemonics work by attaching meaning to otherwise disconnected information. Memory champions use visual imagery and spatial techniques, like the memory palace method, to remember vast amounts of information by placing items to remember along a familiar mental route through a known location. Visualization creates additional neural connections, deepening associations and making memory formation more robust. When writing something important, using all caps, highlighting it, circling it, or drawing a picture makes it visually memorable. The more outlandish the visualization, the more memorable it becomes, like imagining The Rock milking a chocolate cow with Tina Fey catching the milk in her mouth. These techniques aren't just tricks. They leverage how our brains naturally work. By connecting new information to existing knowledge, creating vivid mental images, and testing ourselves repeatedly, we create stronger, more accessible memories that resist forgetting even years later. Episodic memory, your recollection of personal life experiences, is essentially the history of you remembered by you. Our brains excel at remembering what is meaningful, emotional, or surprising while discarding the mundane. The dinners we remember are special, like Thanksgiving 2019, while routine meals fade into oblivion. We don't remember ho-hum experiences unless they have significance or evoke emotion. Habituation causes us to ignore the familiar. We can't remember what we don't notice, like a spouse's routine arrival home. But change that arrival dramatically, coming home early in a Ferrari with George Clooney, and suddenly it becomes memorable. Emotionally charged events create stronger, more detailed memories because emotion activates the amygdala, which signals the hippocampus to consolidate these important experiences. We further strengthen these memories by revisiting and retelling them. Flashbulb memories, exceptionally vivid recollections of shocking, emotionally charged events contain rich contextual details about where you were, who you were with, and how you felt during momentous occasions like 9/11 or personal tragedies. For a public event to create a flashbulb memory, you must feel personally connected to it, whether you're from Boston during the marathon bombing or a runner with no Boston connection. Our autobiographical memories form our life's highlights reel, first kisses, graduations, weddings, births, creating our personal narrative. What we remember depends on our identity and outlook. Optimists recall positive experiences, while pessimists remember complaints and woes. Most autobiographical memories cluster between ages 15 and 30, the reminiscence bump, when we experience many meaningful firsts: first love, first job, first home. Some individuals possess highly superior autobiographical memory, HSAM, recalling details from almost every day of their lives since late childhood. Actress Marlu Henner demonstrates this remarkable ability by instantly recalling specific dates, like July 20, 1977, Wednesday, shooting Blood Brothers with Richard Gere. While she considers HSAM a superpower, others with this ability feel cursed by vividly remembering painful experiences. For those without HSAM, memory improvement strategies include breaking routines, reducing screen time, engaging emotions, discussing experiences, keeping journals, using social media as memory cues, and exploring life-logging technology that can digitally record daily experiences. Our episodic memories, while impressive in some ways, are fundamentally flawed. They contain distortions, additions, omissions, and confabulations at every stage of memory processing. We only encode slices of experience based on what captures our attention, making memories inherently incomplete. During consolidation, memories are highly susceptible to editing. Imagination, opinions, dreams, or suggestions can all alter what we think we remember. Even stored memories aren't safe, as they decay over time and change each time we retrieve them. When we recall a memory, we're reconstructing rather than replaying it, often filling gaps with invented details. Most critically, we reconsolidate this altered version, overwriting the original, like hitting save on an edited document. Through leading questions and suggestive language, researchers have demonstrated how easily false memories can be implanted, with 25 to 50% of subjects remembering fictional events presented to them, and how simple word choices can dramatically alter recall of the same experience. This reconstructive nature explains why eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable despite witnesses' confidence in their memories. It also explains why family members often disagree about shared experiences. Each person reconstructs the event differently based on their perspective, attention, and emotional state at the time. Understanding memory's reconstructive nature doesn't mean we should distrust all our memories. Rather, it suggests humility about our recollections, especially when they conflict with others' memories or objective evidence. Our memories aren't video recordings, but stories we tell ourselves, stories that change subtly each time we tell them. This malleability can be harnessed positively by consciously reframing difficult memories, focusing on what we learned rather than what we lost. We can gradually reshape our relationship with the past. Memory's reconstructive nature means our personal narratives remain works in progress, continually evolving as we grow and change throughout life. Prospective memory, our memory for future tasks, is fundamentally flawed in all humans. Unlike remembering the past, remembering to do something later requires mental time travel and depends on external cues that we often miss. Even critical tasks aren't immune. World-class cellists have forgotten $2.5 million instruments in taxis, and surgeons have left instruments inside patients. Our brains simply aren't wired to reliably remember intentions without proper support systems. To-do lists function like glasses for your prospective memory. They correct a natural deficiency. Don't trust your brain to remember later what you plan now. Write everything down, and most importantly, remember to check your lists. This is why surgeons and pilots use checklists rather than relying on memory for critical procedures. Externalizing your brain's calendar is essential for longer retention intervals. Don't expect to hold intentions in conscious awareness for days. Make a habit of entering future tasks into your calendar and setting alerts that will remind you to look at your schedule. Vague intentions like exercise later today lack specific cues to trigger memory activation. Instead, create implementation intentions. I'm going to yoga at noon. Place visible cues, like your yoga mat by the door, and set specific reminders that account for travel time. Medication adherence is one of the most common prospective memory challenges. Pill boxes organized by day solve both the problem of remembering to take medication and the episodic memory question of whether you've already taken it today. Strategic placement of visual cues prevents prospective memory failures. My boyfriend places items that need to be remembered by the front door where we'd literally trip over them when leaving. This method works because the cues are positioned where you'll notice them at the right time. For medications, place pill boxes next to your toothbrush rather than hidden in a cabinet where they remain unseen. Many of us rely on daily routines as prospective memory cues. Getting ready for bed reminds us to brush teeth. Breakfast prompts medication taking. But when routines change, these built-in reminders disappear. If you skip breakfast because you're running late, you might forget your heart medication. When your day derails, take a moment to identify any prospective memory tasks that were tied to disrupted activities. Whether we remember or forget depends significantly on context. Memory retrieval works best when the conditions during recall match those present during memory formation. This explains the common experience of walking into a room and forgetting why we're there. The context has changed from where the intention formed. A fascinating study with deep sea divers demonstrated this principle perfectly. Divers who learned word lists underwater recalled them better underwater than on the beach, while those who learned on the beach performed better when tested on the beach. The mismatched conditions significantly impaired recall. Context extends beyond physical location to include who we were with, the time of day, weather, and even our internal states. Our emotional state served as powerful context. We more readily recall happy memories when in a good mood and negative ones when feeling down. Similarly, physiological states like hunger, fatigue, or caffeine levels become part of the memory's context. Everything experienced while learning something becomes potentially bound into that memory. If you study vocabulary while listening to Eminem, smelling lavender, eating gummy bears, and feeling tired and anxious, you'll recall those words best under similar conditions. Even language provides context. Someone who immigrated from Italy might retrieve childhood memories in Italian despite speaking English for decades. This principle explains why witnesses sometimes recall additional details when returning to a crime scene, or why you might suddenly remember a conversation when you revisit the location where it occurred. Our brains encode not just information, but the entire experiential context surrounding it. So when you walk into a room and forget why you're there, don't panic. Simply return to where you had the original thought, either physically or mentally, and the context will help deliver the memory. This isn't a sign of cognitive decline, but a reflection of how context-dependent our memory retrieval systems naturally operate. Solomon Sharashevsky, known as S, the man who could not forget, possessed extraordinary memory abilities. Studied by Russian psychologist Alexander Luria over 30 years, he could memorize lengthy number lists, foreign poetry, and complex formulas, recalling them perfectly years later. Yet this remarkable ability was often more burden than blessing, as he struggled to filter irrelevant information or forget what wasn't needed. Forgetting serves vital functions in our memory system. It helps us discard irrelevant information, like old hotel room numbers and previous parking spots that would otherwise interfere with current needs. An intelligent memory system must both remember and forget. While we often view forgetting negatively, it creates mental space by clearing away mundane details, allowing us to focus on what matters. Active forgetting strategies include redirecting attention to prevent encoding, selectively discarding negative self-information during consolidation, avoiding memory-triggering cues, and visualization techniques like Sharashevsky's successful mental erasing of memories on a chalkboard. For muscle memories like typing passwords, only persistent practice of new patterns will overwrite the old ones. Understanding intentional forgetting mechanisms may provide insights into conditions like PTSD, depression, and addiction, where forgetting difficulties prove maladaptive. Ultimately, optimal memory requires balancing retention and disposal, keeping what's meaningful while purging what isn't. Memory exists as a profound paradox, simultaneously everything and nothing. We should take it seriously, but hold it lightly. Memory enables nearly everything we do, from walking and talking to recognizing loved ones, yet it's also notoriously flawed, incomplete, inaccurate, and fallible. By valuing memory's true potential while forgiving its imperfections, we achieve balance. Even memory champions like Akira Haraguchi, who memorized 111,700 digits of pi, forget everyday things like birthdays. Our brains aren't designed to remember routine experiences, but rather what's meaningful. Yet even when meaningful memories fade, as with Alzheimer's, memory doesn't define humanity. Despite 11 years with Alzheimer's, Greg O'Brien retains his humor, faith, presence, and ability to form rich relationships. The author's grandmother, though unable to recognize family members in late-stage Alzheimer's, still felt and expressed love. Memory enables much of human experience, but doesn't constitute its essence. We can lose memories while retaining our capacity for emotion, connection, and meaning.